And without much further ado, I'd like to go into this conversation with Chelsea Manning. I am so in awe that Chelsea is here with us. And you know, a few years ago, we showed the video, Collateral Murder, and I said at the time that whoever released this is a true hero. And I mean that just as much today. Sometimes the truth is something that hurts us, something we don't want to confront, but we have to. And that's something all of us in the hacker community, I think we get, because we're always asking questions and people always telling us to shut up and just accept the answer. All right, but we just keep persisting until we find out the truth, and sometimes we don't like the answer. And I know there are a lot of people who aren't cool with where we're going with certain things or the answers that we're putting out, and the dialogue is welcome, and the argument is welcome. But the other thing that's welcome is respect and just an atmosphere where people don't feel fear for being themselves. And I think that's something that I really have to admire Chelsea for, because not only did she come forward and tell the truth at great personal risk and cost, but she has also led for so many people who are feeling oppression or feeling like they cannot be themselves. She's a shining example of how to do that right. And I'm just so in awe of what she has accomplished and what she will continue to accomplish. And without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Chelsea Manning and Yan Zhu, brilliant technologist, who will be interviewing her. We'll be taking questions a little bit later on. Enjoy.
Thank you, Manuel.
All right, here we are.
Yeah. So I was here in 2010 when we saw the Collateral Murder video and everyone was talking about it and it was such a big deal and everyone was talking about you, and now finally 8 years later you're here. So how does that feel? What's it like to be at Hope?
I mean, it's great. I was actually wanting to come to Hope that year. But I got a little busy,
yeah,
I guess.
I can imagine.
So, yeah. It's quite incredible. I mean, it was certainly an emotional experience, and I enjoy the. I've been doing software hacking, and network hacking since I was 12. So, I created my first Linux box when I was 13. So. Yeah, it was years ago. But yeah, it's very emotional to be with the community that I came from in the beginning. And we knew each other prior to all this.
Yeah, that kind of changed some things in my life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, we met at right next to the MIT campus in 2009.
Yeah. Yeah. What have your interactions with people here been like? Do you feel like part of this hacker community? Or
yeah, I was over at the hardware hacking table when I saw me.
Yeah.
I'm working with Raspberry Pis, so.
You want to talk more about what you're up to with that, or?
Yeah, sure. In general, I'm working with, I'm actually trying to convert some drivers that are written in C into Rust, so that way I can actually use Rust to do the actual hardware part. I'm also working on trying to get the communications between the Raspberry Pis, but I'm using different hardware, so I'm experimenting with different wireless hardware types. So SDR is now a big thing.
Yeah.
So I've been playing, there's been leaps and bounds in how affordable software-defined radio has been. So
that's awesome. Yeah, and obviously Rust is kind of a new language as well.
And oh, and it's great. I used to be the C person.
Right.
I
was you told me you love C.
Yeah, I was a C programmer, and I'm now a Rust programmer.
Yeah, so what else in the past 8 years, technology-wise, has been really exciting to you to come out and see? What are your favorite technological advances?
Well, it's actually the things that scare me. I actually have seen a lot of advances and developments in a lot of the things that I was working on. I was actually doing a lot of statistical analysis and predictive analysis based upon statistics, a lot of work with that while I was in the military, mm-hmm. and before that whenever I was in the private sector. And, you know, like there's some scary stuff that we were doing, and, you know, it was just like not prime time for this technology. Mm-hmm. And I still think that, you know, like, and we've shifted from, you know, a more primitive mathematical construct to do predictive analysis to machine learning and, you know, neural networks. And you know, I now have a box with a bunch of GPUs that just, you know, that's why I have, you know, like, and so I'm using like CUDA and, you know, these neural networks, and there's been so much advancement in this area, but it's like how it's getting used mm-hmm. is what scares me, because we're not like humans. I don't feel like society and humans have really worked out the ethics of what we actually use these things in applications for. Like right. I also feel like the development cycle is so fast and mm-hmm. is working so so aggressively towards, you know, selling products or, you know, killing people, that it's, you know, it's just like what are we doing? Like, we have advanced this far with this technology, and, you know, the first thing that we do is we use it to try to kill people. So
yeah, so there's probably a lot of people in the audience who work at technology companies developing things like or similar to the things you just mentioned.
Yeah.
So what's your advice for people who are in that role and may have ethical concerns about their work?
My advice to them is make your own decisions. We as developers understand the technology that we're using often, but also think about the ethical implications of that technology that you're working on. We're not just making tools, and we're not just developing software, you know. We are, this software is impacting the entire, you know, huge segments of the population now, you know.
Right.
And so when we do these things, and, you know, it's becoming more life and death, you know, it's becoming more, or, you know, just like credit reporting. You know, and predictive predicting like whether or not you're going to be a criminal, or, you know, predictive policing is another means that we end up destroying people's lives with the software that we make because it's getting misused and mishandled. Mm-hmm. But we have an ethical obligation to understand the implications of the software, or to at least discover. And, you know, in the same way that, you know, if you're a developer, you're going to do the first thing that you do if you're a good software engineer is do a feasibility assessment. And that there should be more to that. There should be like an ethical assessment. Like, what are the implications of this technology going to be, and how can we safeguard that? Or should we even develop this? Should we even go down this path? You know, and I think that looking beyond the requirements set by companies or, you know, NGOs or the government, instead of looking at the development requirements instead of hitting those, think about the broader implications, and like, because they're probably not thinking about that stuff either. So I think that we have, you know, especially because we also have the ability to withhold our skills from these systems.
Yeah.
You know, and I know that's asking a lot for people who make $200,000 a year, and, you know, but like, it's $200,000 a year, or, you know, are you going to be denying millions of people access to, I don't know, like, life, credit, basic necessities, food, you know, political rights, because like that's what it's boiling down to. And, you know, I think that companies also aren't, you know, they're developing software that has unintended consequences that are harmful across the board, but it's not because that's their intent. It's the fact that because they didn't think this stuff out, because they're so focused on, you know, profits, that, you know, it's having these impacts, and you've already affected millions of people. And I'm, you know, like, look at voting, like, mm-hmm. look at, you know, voting machines, or, you know, and I'm thinking about, Facebook and, you know, Twitter with how, like, you know, like how these social media platforms are being used and abused and how the data from that is being used and abused. And, like, it's these unintended consequences of the systems that we make that are really having an impact.
Yeah. So what about the case where you're in an organization that's really driven towards these goals like profit and you feel like you're the only person who cares about ethics or you feel alone? Like, do you have advice for people in that situation?
You probably understand that situation more than anyone else, and you should base your decisions off that experience. Hmm. That's the best that I can say. That's the best advice I can give, because not every situation is the same. Every moral and ethical dilemma is a quandary in and of itself. There's no be-all, end-all, you know, one-size-fits-all rule here. And you know, we have political agency. We have political power, even as software developers. We have an ethical obligation, but we also have this power. We have actual power, and we can do something about it. And what you do is going to vary depending on where you fit in these systems. Mm-hmm. But you know, you will know what that is. And you know, and I think that you should follow your gut and follow your intuition in those situations. And that's the best that I can say. That's the best advice I can give. Do something.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and I'm sure you're an inspiration to a lot of us in that regard. Oh no, water spill.
There's more.
There's plenty. So switching gears a bit, since you talked about politics, you recently ran for the Senate
in
Maryland. Can you talk a bit about what your motivations were for doing that and how you picked the particular set of issues to focus on?
Yeah, I wanted to use the political process to get ideas out there and to move and shape the conversation. When you run for political office, you're given a platform. And I wanted to be able to say the things that I believe, not the things that I think will get me elected, but the things that I believe and bring them to the table. You know, things like abolish ICE, things like, you know, close prisons, things like defund police departments. And, you know, I believe in these things, and I think that they should be on the table, and that was why I ran. And, you know, and I made a very calculated decision. I remember I basically had a small campaign staff, mm-hmm. and we had a meeting together before we announced, and shortly after we announced, and what do we do? Like, should we, you know, try to, should we change our principles, you know, in order to try and win, and then use like an actual, like use like, you know, a Senate office to do these things? Or do we want to not change our principles, say the things we want to say, do the things that we want to do, and start from there? And I think we all came to a consensus that we were going to move forward with saying the things that we actually believe.
That's awesome. And yeah, props to that. So what did you learn from the whole experience, and what are your next steps?
Well, it was actually funny because I went out canvassing, mm-hmm. and I didn't do it like with as a photo op moment or anything like that. I didn't post any photos of it on Twitter. I didn't talk about it, you know, publicly, but I did actually go out canvassing. And so I went all across the state of Maryland, particularly in Baltimore, and I just knocked on people's doors and, you know, registered voters. And I just said, hey, you know, what are the issues you care about? And that was, it was tough because I got grilled by some real, genuine people who have real issues, real problems, and I didn't always have the answer. And you know, and I'm really more of an activist. I'm not a politician. I kind of suck at being a politician, honestly. I'm way better at being a sysadmin than a politician. So you know, I you know, uh, so like standing on the doorstep of somebody who has real problems and real issues and is struggling and being grilled by them and really intelligently. Like the it wasn't journalists who asked me the most profound questions. It was standing on somebody's doorstep where people feel really confident and having them ask you a tough question and being put on the spot like that. That was one of the toughest things I've ever done. And I had to openly admit sometimes, like, I don't have an answer that's really complicated. I have never thought about that before. I want to get back to you. Like, I'd like to email you back or send a letter back, you know, and maybe come up with an answer, but I don't know. And that was tough to say. It was tough to be grilled on somebody's doorstep.
Mm. Can you give some examples of the questions people asked you?
Yeah. People had these stories. They had these, like, powerful emotional stories about, you know, the struggle that they're going through. I remember I talked on the porch with a woman in she was an elderly lady, a woman of color in Baltimore, and I stood on her porch. And she wouldn't open the door, so we talked through the screen door, and I was okay with that. And she, you know, like, she's like, "Oh yeah, I've been voting for 40 years, and I'm sick and tired of it. I've been voting and voting and voting, and things just get progressively worse. They get progressively worse in my community. They get worse and worse and worse. And all these politicians come and they knock on my door and they say the same things and they make the same promises and they tell me all these, you know, they say they're going to give the world to us and then they never do. And I didn't want to be the person who did the same thing. Mm-hmm. So." I didn't make her any promises. Oh. And I didn't tell her any BS. And it was tough to hear that story, you know. And she had, like, a daughter who, you know, got cancer and needed health care and was too expensive. And, you know, like, we just... Like, that's an anecdote, but, like, yeah. Doing this, like, I did this a couple hundred times, you know, I did this several hundred times, and so everybody wow. had, like, something powerful like this.
Wow, that's incredible. Did that experience change or impact your politics in any way? Like, what was the effect it had on you?
Yeah, you know, I think that we have a political system that is inherently unfair, that is inherently biased, and is really tough and intense to, like, work in. And it's an environment that closes, you know, it closes resources off to people and makes it inaccessible. And you can't get these ideas out there because, like, the price of running a campaign is immense. You know, the price of hiring staff is immense, and, like, getting even in the door is so difficult. And I don't have a whole lot of confidence in, you know, the American political system. And I think that there are other political systems that obviously have a better balance that I think that we should think about and we should try, you know. And I think that I think that campaign finances and the expectation of having advertising, you know, like, enormous amounts of advertising for budgets. I mean, which I didn't advertise. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't buy any television advertising slots. And we didn't have those, like, I didn't feel, you know, comfortable from an environmental standpoint to have yard signs. I thought, like, I don't want to leave a bazillion yard signs and, like, poles in the ground. We decided not to go with, you know, like, doing these things. And in order for you to have traction, you know, in the system that we have, you know, you're expected to have these things. So, I kept on getting, like, people kept on asking me, like, why aren't you really running? And I'm like, well, I am. It's just, like, I'm doing it in my own way. I'm not doing these things, and I'm consciously not doing these things that you expect the campaign to do. Because, you know, I thought I'd give it a try. And, you know, it didn't work. So, you know, mm-hmm. I don't think that that, you know, the I think that the bar is too high.
Hmm. If you had to run again, well, not that you would ever be forced to, obviously.
Yeah.
But would you, so would you do things differently? Would you do more of the traditional politician route?
I don't know. You know, and I've really thought about it. You know, and like I said, I'm actually a way better activist and sysadmin than I am. You know, we had great email. Like our email works. our website was very GDP. Secure. Russia did not get any of our emails.
That's awesome. So there might since the last election in 2016, I've heard more and more like hackers and people who aren't traditionally politicians without, you know, a politics background express interest in running for office, whether it's at a local level or something higher up than that. Do you have advice for those people who aren't from politics and want to get elected?
If you go down the traditional route, it will change you. You'll have to change your principles. You have to,
wow,
to let go of some of the things that you care about in order to fit in and in order for you to be accepted in this environment. And that's unfair and it's improper, but like that's what they expect, you know? And I think it's funny whenever like these, whenever like the Maryland DNC says like, oh yeah, we're not gonna interfere, you know, but then they interfere covertly, you know, behind the scenes, you know, like that's just, you know, you know, it's, yeah, it's like that. This is like, if you have actual principles, you will find it incredibly hard.
Wow.
So like you either have to let go of those or, I mean, good luck.
Pretty depressing.
I mean, it is. And I think that's, you know, like that was something that I learned.
Hmm. I had another question. Yeah, so earlier this year, you tweeted something like, voting doesn't change anything. Do you still stand by that? And like, if so, what do you mean? Like, what's answer other than voting?
You know, I wrote those tweets after a really rough weekend with canvassing, and I was actually really kind of wore out and depressed, and that was what people were telling me. You know, that this consistently, person after person was telling me, I vote and I vote and I vote and nothing ever, you know, nothing's getting better.
Mm.
And so, I just went with that. And I think that we should be demanding more. We should be asking more. And I think that we should be depending less on these institutions to solve our problems. I mean, we have communities. We have people to depend on. We have people that if we just look out for one another, you know, we might be able to solve some of these problems. And I think that that's what I'm trying to get at with that is, you know, that was based off of what I was hearing again and again. And, you know, it was a tough moment for me because like I felt less confidence in the system that we have, and so do a lot of people. And I was just saying that. I was just conveying the fact that so many people think this now.
Yeah. So you're saying people should do more for each other, you know, form stronger communities.
Yeah. And I think
like that.
I think that we have each other, and that's enough, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Like, do we need these huge institutional bodies to tell us how to like run our communities? And like, because like every single community that I saw got, you know, and you know, every time that the state or federal government got involved, like it just messed everything up even worse. You know, and this was consistent across the board. You know, rural places like out near Hagerstown, or urban places like Baltimore, or suburban places like Montgomery County. Mm-hmm. You know, like there were tons of places, coastal towns. You know, like again and again. You know, but it was the problems were different each time. But it was fun. But what was funny was that, and the people affected were different each time. But what was funny is that it was the same institutions causing the same problem, like different problems in different locations. And I think that You know, and this goes into like the notion of intersectionality. You know, like if we can get all these groups to come together and agree on making a difference in our own communities, and then, you know, like supporting each other across the state or even across the world, you know, then we can accomplish so much more.
Yeah. Are you interested in becoming more of a like a community organizer?
I mean, well, I am a community organizer. I'm involved in, you know, I try to be involved as involved as possible in the various communities that I'm a part of. And you know, often quietly, you know, I don't, you know, like I'll show up in the back of, you know, a meeting, or I'll support, you know, like I do jail and prisoner support, mm-hmm. Which is the most, I think that's the most passionate thing that I do, mm-hmm. is I try to write letters to prisoners. I try to encourage people to write letters to prisoners. I try to encourage people to, you know, continue to reach out and, you know, and then also like whenever you get released from prison, it's not an easy deal. Like, you know, like I had access to all these resources and all this, like, I'm a really well-known person, but like most people don't have that. And, you know, we should be providing this to people from our communities.
Was that largely informed by your own experiences in prison and the
right and facing trial? You know, I attended many of the, like, I had a few friends who were on trial from the J-20 case.
Right.
You know, so 200 people arrested on inauguration day of 2017, mostly for. And their charge was conspiracy and was for wearing all black, you know? So anybody who was wearing black in this area that got kettled was charged with conspiracy. So I attended all of their, I attended as many hearings as I could back quietly in the back and provided support. And I tweeted about it on occasion. And like, this is what I do. Like, it's what I enjoy. It's what I think, it's what I'm passionate and I care about. So, and you know, and they, most of them are fine now, so you know most of the charges got dropped. So like we're thrilled about that.
That's awesome. So you mentioned writing letters to prisoners. Is there any other ways that people here could support people in prison?
Yeah, and you know I think the most important thing that we can do is we can stop writing people off. You know, like, it's really hard, and it's really hard to do that, because even if you are supportive, like, after about 2 or 3 years, you kind of forget about these, you know, you forget about folks, because you don't see them all the time.
Right.
They're not, you know, and actually, like, I have, you know, in activism, I see that, you know, there's a lot of activism about, you know, police violence and brutality, and, like, and it's usually focused on, you know, in the streets. And I'm just like, well, there's 2.2 million people at any time in prison in the United States or in jails in the United States, and so there's state violence happening there all the time, you know. But often we forget about that, and you know, yeah. That, you know, like, you know, what you know, it's funny. Whenever I was in prison, I actually get asked this a lot. You know, people are like, oh, well, there's all these like violent, scary people in prison, and you're not like violent and scary. And I'm like, the most violent and scary people that I encountered in prison were the prison guards, time and time again. So, whenever mistakes happen in society, you know. Like, we get hammered for it, but whenever the government makes does a terrible thing or makes a mistake, like, it just, like, whatever. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, let's do some more uplifting things.
Yeah, so I don't want to talk too much about prison if you don't want to, but.
Well, I mean, like, let's talk about. I mean, you came to visit me.
I did come to visit you.
You were one of the few people who could, because you knew me before.
Yeah, so there's this really stupid rule that, I guess at least in military prison.
Well, in this particular one,
In this particular place, Leavenworth, you could only visit Chelsea if she could prove that she knew you before incarceration, which is kind of difficult.
Yeah. And so like that got rid of a lot of people right off the bat, a lot of support, you know, because like a lot of people came out and were supportive. So a lot of the supporters that came together, you know, were people that I didn't necessarily know before, you know, going to prison. But
yeah,
I mean, you were different in the fact that, you know, we were both, I mean, you were an MIT, you know, physics student at the time. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm really into physics. I wanted to study physics too.
Yeah.
And, totally. You know, like that didn't work out, but.
It's not too late though.
I mean, I'm not interested in physics as much as I used to be. I mean, I'm interested in the math, but now I'm doing more like cryptography.
Yeah. So you had a interest in quantum or post-quantum cryptography.
I do. And so I've read an enormous number of papers and I studied an enormous number of papers while I was in prison. And it's funny, like there was a lot of stuff we couldn't get into prison because, you know, there's like rules and censorship and all this stuff. So like of all the things to like actually make it into prison was like really advanced, like brand new cryptography papers, like lattice-based cryptography, real ring learning with errors type stuff. And
you think they just didn't understand it, so they're like, whatever.
I mean, they're just like, what is this? It's math. It looks like math. All right. There's like Greek all over it.
Right. So if someone wanted to send you like a really secret message, all they had to do was hide it in like a cryptography paper.
I mean, I'm not going
to get to you.
I'm not going to suggest that. But yeah, like I just thought that of all the things.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, you know, and I, you know, so I studied a lot of this stuff while I was in, you know, I kept up to date with a lot of things going on in cryptography while I was in prison. And I tried writing code, but it was a little tough without a computer.
You were just like pencil and paper.
Yeah, it was a lot of, I was using, through a friend over the phone.
Mm-hmm.
I had learned, because I already knew Python. So what's that math? That
NumPy?
Yeah, one of these.
Shout out your favorite math modules.
So yeah, there was this like Python-like math tool that I was using to like to do most of my work. And I, you know, it was like 2 years ago, so I can't quite remember.
So you would like ask someone to type it into an interpreter and then like read you the results.
Yeah, and I had to ask an actual program and it'd be like, well, this syntax really matters. And it was a layperson like typing it up for me. So I'm like, this syntax really matters. Yeah, what are they doing wrong? It's like indentations are wrong because it's Python.
That sounds so painful. Like I'm never going to complain about a coding interview ever again. So what was
it? Python's not my favorite language, by the way.
Yeah. What is your favorite, Rust?
It's Rust. Nice. I mean, we just talked about that.
Yeah. What was it like to get out of prison and use a computer for the first time?
Weren't you there?
Oh yeah, I was. Well, that was the first time.
I mean, pretty much. Like, wow. I mean, it wasn't the first time I'd used like an electronic device. It was like cell phones before that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, like cell phones and because I didn't actually. The thing was, I didn't own a computer yet, and my lawyers were like, "Hey, can we buy you a computer?" And I'm like, "Do you know how to buy a computer that's really secure?" Like, I'm not gonna order this online. I'm not like, you know, like so it's very, you know, so that was why I waited, and I waited until y'all showed up.
Yeah,
like, this like pack of.
We had like a computer buying for Chelsea task force. it was an ordeal.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it's super secure.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Not bad.
So what was did you like get right back into like coding and network sysadmin stuff or?
Yeah. Well, I had to catch up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whenever it comes to like sysadmin stuff, I wasn't as familiar with like virtual machine platforms as I am now. So now I use a crap ton of virtual machines. You know, like there's so much more capabilities in terms of like network security and a lot of advances and like there's a lot of more warning systems and like mailing lists for this kind of thing, which I had to catch up on like the vulnerabilities that have been identified that didn't make national headlines. And also I think that, you know, like, I mean, Docker is brand new. I'd never used a Docker container before and now I use Docker containers all the time. So, you know, like it was just, it was, But here's the funny thing is having this like background, like going back to the late 90s in like tech, you know, in computers and technology meant that, you know, it was like building on top of this already previous knowledge. It wasn't like I was being introduced mm-hmm. to things. I was actually like, things are actually easier now. And I was just like, that's funny. Like I thought maybe, you know, things would be harder, but actually a lot of the stuff that I thought, gosh, wouldn't it be great if this was automated are now automated. No. you know.
Yeah, I guess a lot happened in 7 years.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and like it's so great. Like I just have to do a Docker pull and I'm like, yep, I got that Postgres server.
So are you interested in doing more like hacker stuff, software engineering, sysadmining?
Yeah, so I've shifted my interests to hardware hacking. So a lot of Raspberry Pis. I probably have about 20 right now. So,
wow.
I'm using it for various purposes. My favorite is the SNES and N64 ROM emulator that I have hooked up to my TV.
Nice.
That's fun.
Nice. How do you pick what projects to work on? Space.
Either an interest or an actual demand.
Yeah.
So. Many of the projects that I work on now, I started doing small scale projects first. Now I'm doing like medium term, like stuff that's going to take me a couple months or, you know, like, so I have long term like goals and, I can never tell if it's going to be the moment to like reveal my secret GitHub account, but cuz I don't feel confident enough and I worry that, you know, like if everybody knows that this is the code that I'm writing, that it, you know, like people think it's better somehow, you know. It's like Stephen King like wrote as like somebody else for like 3 years and his books not under his name like didn't sell, and like as soon as people found out it was Stephen King books, they were selling all over the place, you know. I'm just worried about that. So
yeah.
I want people to just use the code and like work on the code and be able to work on that without the knowledge that, you know, like my name is attached to it.
Interesting. So are you going to release some projects anonymously in the future?
Well, I'm already doing that. But you know they're very small. You know, like it's mostly subcomponents that like prerequisites that because I'm programming in Rust, I find that a lot of the C wrappers for, you know, like the wrappers for Rust to go to a C library are, you know, not up to par yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been contributing to some of those projects. Or in some cases, if it's a small enough library, I'll just rewrite the library.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of them have been posted to, you know, they're not all cargo packages, but like I'm certainly thinking about the things that I may eventually become their own cargo packages, but I am contributing as it stands to Rust development.
That's awesome. Do you think you would pursue a career in software development someday?
I don't know. Is anybody hiring?
A couple hands in the audience.
Yeah. So, I'm kind of more of a public figure right now as it stands.
Right.
So, I do plan on, you know, and I am transitioning more and more to doing my own work. You know, eventually, what I want to do is I want to be able to write a white paper, mm-hmm. and maybe, you know, either a security white paper or like a, you know, something along those lines, and actually be able to write something, and then, you know, have it stand on its own. I want to, you know, I'm here today because of what happened, you know, mm-hmm. 8 years ago. But, you know, I still have things that I can contribute. I still have,
right.
I still have insight, and I still have experience, and I still have knowledge, and I still have an interest in this stuff. So, y'all are gonna start seeing some interesting Woo. Things coming from me in the future.
Awesome! So excited for that. So what has your day-to-day life been like recently? Is it super busy?
Absolute
activism? Chaos.
I never know what city I'm going to wake up in. I've been out to... I mean, I was just at Roskilde in Denmark like a couple weeks ago. A couple weeks before that, I was in Berlin. I saw some of our friends there. Before that, I was... after that, I was in Italy for a while. And then I've been all over the U.S. I mean, we met up a couple times in SF. And even though I've settled... I've mostly settled in where I used to live, Montgomery County, Maryland, and I'm planning on staying there for a while. But I feel like I'm commuting an awful lot across the country. So I spent an awful lot of time in New York.
Yeah.
Probably about a third of my life so far, like out of prison, has been spent in New York.
Wow. So I know initially you had some trouble with international travel.
Oh yeah, I tried to go to Canada and they banned me.
Forever? Are you still banned?
But they said forever, and then they're like,
Wow. Actually,
you know, maybe sometimes.
Uh-huh. Just when we feel like it.
Yeah. So
soft ban.
There's still a fight to gain full admissibility, where I just walk. I'm just like, hey, here's my passport, and then walk across. As it stands, I have to ask for permission first.
For Canada or for every country?
For every single time, I have to ask Canada for permission.
For Canada.
Yeah,
right.
So I have to put in a full visa request every single time as it stands.
Hmm.
And I just did this when I went to Montreal a few weeks ago.
Wow. Have you had trouble with other border crossings? Or
no, the EU has been very friendly.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm just I'm in Europe. All right.
That's awesome. Do you get recognized a lot when you're just on the street or at events?
Yeah, I do. I'm not used to that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not used to that one bit. I worry about it just a little bit because I like to walk down the street as a normal person, and I'm just I'm very, I walk around the conference and I'm just hey, I'm just hanging out, doing stuff. And, having a lot of people come up to me, it can be, it's great, but it's also it gets in the way a little bit sometimes, especially whenever I'm commuting on the metro and I'm I'm really late right now. And somebody's hey, can we take a selfie? And I'm yeah, sure. Really, really fast. Or can we get on the train first? Or, something like that. And it's this isn't my stop. And I'm well, just come along for one stop and come back. it's a lot. And, I think that there's a lot of expectations that have been placed on me,
mm-hmm.
And I just, I was 22 when I got locked up. And I spent 8 years of my life in prison. It sounds cliche, but prison's all I know. I mean, that's really true. It's actually true. So I'm making a lot of there's a lot of new things that I'm learning. I had never rented my own place before. Now I pay rent and I pay bills, and I went from being homeless to living with my aunt to being in the military. So I never had my own place to live in, mm-hmm. before, and so this is the first time I'm living out on my own. And I want to talk a little bit about my adjustment, because mm-hmm. it's been really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really only starting to grasp how hard it's been. I've been kind of I'm really struggling sometimes because I spent a year in solitary confinement, and so I have some anxieties and fears associated with that I don't like to talk about. There's social stuff that I'm used to, prison dynamics, prison social dynamics, and how assertive and aggressive you have to be in order to interact with people is, I think, I can be a little forward sometimes and a little blunt sometimes. And Like sometimes, and I've actually done this. Like I did this a few months ago. I got up in the middle of the night and I felt lonely, and I was in my own apartment. I was in my bedroom, and I felt the temptation to like beat on the wall and just say, "Hey, how's it going?" And I was just like that was normal for me at one point in my life, and it's not anymore. And it's like living on my own, like, is the first time that I've never been around people for years on end. I mean, except for that period in solitary confinement in 2010,
right.
And early 2011, I was around lots of people, and I got used to that, and I enjoyed the communal environment, you know. It doesn't have to be a prison environment for it to be communal, but I did enjoy the camaraderie, and you know, like. Activism can happen in prison, and people can be, like, people can be power. I mean, people have power even if in prison, and especially against, you know, the prison system. You know, like on multiple occasions when I was in prison, like I saw completely spontaneously and independent of any, like, you know, of anything else. People say, you know, like guards would come up to somebody, and sometimes it would be even somebody that people don't like. They're like, I don't really like this person, mm-hmm. you know? And then like, but as soon as like the guards would start screwing with this person, there'd be like 8 or 9 people would be like, hey, back off, you know?
Mm.
So, you know, like prison, you know, like that works and it's effective, and, you know, and like having that camaraderie and knowing that people are going to come, you know, back you up and support you, was very important. And you know, it was simple things like, you know, like simple things that were totally against the rules. Like, you know, we had to put in these ration requests, and we've talked about this mm-hmm. on multiple occasions, you know, how difficult it was to, like, you had to submit paper, like, rations requests, and you could not screw anything up on the form. Mm-hmm. So if you screwed something up on the form, then you didn't get your rations. So this happened all the time. You know, people would be in need of shoes or new underwear or, you know, a uniform or toiletries, toilet paper, and they would be denied these things because they didn't fill out the paperwork properly, or oftentimes because they lost, you know, the prison lost the paperwork, which it's on them. And so, like, we would get screwed out of stuff. And so we created this system of, like, stockpiling. We stockpiled people who did get their rations, we got extra rations, and we started stockpiling it. And then, you know, whenever somebody got screwed, we'd be like, hey, here's some stuff, you know, like, here you go. Like, no big deal. You know, and like, that's totally against the rules. And the guy, like, you know, the prison would crack down on that. But it's like, hey, just give the guy shoes. Just give the guy toothpaste, for crying out loud. You know, and, you know, like that's some powerful mutual aid and assistance. And this is happening in one of the, like, human beings are being treated like this, and yet we're, instead of being animals, like, we're coming together as, like, a community. And that's what I learned while I was in prison, was just how powerful, you know, the instinct of community really is, that even in a place like prison, and, you know, all across the board, we have this ability.
Thank you. Are you trying to recreate communities like that outside of, now that you're out?
Yeah, and you know, and I see them now,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't realize I had them sometimes, and because I was like cut off for so long, you know, I value my relationships more than I did before. I took them for granted. I took my friendships for granted. I took my family for granted. I took a lot of things for granted, and having them taken away has made me realize the value of some of the not physical things, like, you know, like, you know, like if my computer goes, like, oh well, you know, just, it's like a physical object, you know, like it's replaceable. The connections and valuable relationships that we have are not replaceable. And I value that more, and I care about that more.
Yeah. Do you feel supported in your everyday life? Like yeah, you mentioned feeling lonely definitely. In the middle of the night.
I mean, come on, you're a part of this. You're part of my support network.
Thanks. Yeah. Do you think, so I know in prison you got letters from people and that was like a huge source of joy and support for you.
Yeah.
Are you still getting letters or is there like...
No, I don't really have, I mean, people can just email me now or tweet at me. So it's a lot, it's a lot easier. Like you don't have to, spend this postage anymore. And honestly, like, please don't flood my P.O. box.
Yeah.
I do have bills and packages that I need to find. I'm still waiting on this FOIA request. It's actually taken a couple years. It's taken, a few months after the commutation was announced, before I got out of prison, submitted a FOIA request and I asked for, hey, you know, like, what's y'all's count of how many letters I got? Because like what we've been one of the estimates that we've gotten is almost 300,000 letters and packages.
Wow.
And yeah. So it was pretty astounding the number. And it was just such a huge vault. I mean, like at one point the prison actually was like up. They like had to add another staff member to like go through it all. Because like more than half of the prison's mail was my mail.
Uh-huh. Wow. So you're saying that if we all just sent more mail and like DDoS the prison with mail, they would have had just like keep hiring people to manage that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow, that's great.
Because then they have to like, and then they just gave up censoring some stuff. They're just like, they're just like, okay, whatever. Like it's probably just like, you know. And the thing was, is I was actually limited in what I could actually physically have. So I was given like a time frame. So like I was only allowed 40 letters in my cell at any one time. I was also only allowed 40 of any combination of books, magazines, or any kind of publication like of that kind. And that was a very limiting number, you know? And so I had to be very judicious in what I selected to have at any one time. And I always went through the mail, but the worst part about getting that amount of mail, it was having to go through it all very quickly because I didn't have a whole lot of time to have it. Mm. Because by the end of the night, when I couldn't physically take it to the, because I had to throw it away. Mm. I mean, I just didn't have, it was way too expensive to like ship somewhere and I don't have anywhere to put it, you know. Like it would fill up two storage units, like two big storage units to try to fit it all. And trying to get all, you know, trying to go through all this mail, you know, on a routine basis, I had to throw a lot of it away and I felt bad about that, you know. But it was just the prison rules, and if I kept it, then I would have got wrote up, so.
Yeah. Did you read every single letter that was...
I mean, I tried to. One or two might have slipped the cracks, but I really tried, and it was very powerful to me for me to go through that. I had like a system going. I was like, I'm going to like triage this. So like, these are cards, these are letters. I'm going to go through the cards first, get rid of those. And then I got the letters and I might be able to get away with, you know, like keeping some letters for a little longer. So like I had the 40 limit. So I tried to make that go faster. Luckily like legal materials were considered separate from that rule. Mm-hmm. So like my legal material like box, which was pretty big. And I learned how to information theory, y'all, like I was able to compress all that stuff and like I was able to get like I actually had sometimes I would have like 9 letter size, the 8x11 8.5x11 like sheets of paper, but like blown like shrunk, so I would have 9 of them like in like a 3x3 row, because I used the copier to like, you know, I would be like, hey, here's 18 pages, I'm gonna make it double sided with 9 on each side, and like I would have to like squint to read it, but like I would have an enormous amount of legal material, so 18 pages would be compressed to 1 page, and I was like, this is like this is how this works. It was like the prison tar.bz, but tar.bz too, you know.
Did people try to send you like items that you couldn't get? And if so, like, what were the weirdest things like people tried to?
I have no idea where to start with that.
Like food or, you know.
Yeah, people tried to send me food. People tried to send me lots of banned items. Like, it was not it was occasional, like, but like over 6 years of not being in solitary confinement, that accumulated. So yeah, like I got a lot of weird stuff. I'm trying to remember what the weirdest thing is, because you know, like it's really hard. But some weird stuff that I got was I got a lot of yoga stuff. Let's just put it that way. Like I got like yoga mats and like oils and scents and like candles, and I'm like, this is not gonna get in. Like, just read the rules.
Yeah,
like, you know, they're posted on the website. We did post them online. So yeah, there was a lot of people try to send me CDs and, you know, like other things like discs, USB keys. Like nobody tried to sell me try to give me a cell phone. So I'm really glad about that, because that would have been really bad. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Wow. So you said CDs, and obviously, like, you probably couldn't listen to them, or.
Yeah, like I had to. I didn't even get them in my possession. I got a notification, right. Like, here's the item. We're disposing of it. You can't have this.
Right. So I know you were really into music, and I mean, probably still are. Were you, like, did you listen to what the latest hits were while in prison?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I had access to the top 40 radio stations.
Oh God.
We had the worst. We didn't have MP3 players, so we couldn't get music. So we had these like little radios, and they were clear acrylic cases, so that way you could see, like, in case we were putting contraband in there or something like that. So like these clear acrylic cases, and I'm like, I'm electronic, like I'm a hardware hacker. Like, you won't see like any changes that I make to this, but anyway. Like the little radios, they that was all I got, was like local radio stations, and so I got a lot of the Kansas City latest and greatest hits. And luckily, I mean, the one thing that I did enjoy was that they did on Saturday night, they had on the like the top radio station there, they had a night for just electronic music for like 4 hours, and I'm just like, all right, this is my time. I mean, you know, like it was Saturday night, so that was like my chill night. I would save rations and I like eat candy and dance and have fun. And, like, I wasn't the only one either, because like there were some other people who like dance music, so we'd like get together and be like, all right, it's time, let's do it.
Wow, have you thought about getting back into DJing since?
No comment. No, yeah, I'm already. Yeah, I got my synth. I just got some synth. I actually went down. I was at Moogfest a few weeks ago, and I actually got a couple synthesizers while I was there. So nice. When I sit down and get around to doing it, I'm gonna start doing some stuff. And you know, and it's great. You know, like there's so many more tools, and you know, software emulation has gotten to the point where I don't need these analog systems as much. I don't use like but I am like a hardware nerd, so I do appreciate like things like vacuum tubes and you know, like I like to turn knobs. I don't like to just use a screen, you know. So I actually like to physically touch things and wire things and connect them. So I'm kind of nerding out on that. And you know, I'm learning about new tools and techniques that electronic musicians are using now. So. I'm doing some exciting. Yeah, I'm excited. I'm gonna do some stuff. And more importantly, if I do a DJ set and I do produce my own tracks, I want to be clear on this. I'm gonna use a pseudonym because I want it to be actually good. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't want to like pull like a Paris Hilton or anything, and like use my name to be like, look, listen to this, and like totally suck. So. Mm-hmm. I'd rather actually like get a feel for how people like the music first.
Yeah, send us your SoundCloud. Someday.
One of these days.
Yeah.
And there's actually a playlist out there of like tracks that I listen to. I don't know. Somebody knows where it is. I don't actually know. I didn't put it up. It was a list I came up with while I was in prison. So
that's awesome.
And obviously, I would add to it now because there's new stuff. Mm-hmm.
So I think we've touched a lot on the topic of your fame and how that impacts your life and the ability to do things you like, such as music and open source work.
Right.
Do you find it like, you know, how do you feel about that? It seems very limiting in a way.
No, it's not limiting. What I try to do is I try to remember where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm constantly, because, you know, going to prison for 7 years has changed me in very profound ways. I know I'm the same person, but I also have these additional experiences. And I always remember that. And I have a few things to remind, there's a few things in my living room to remind me of where it came from. You know, there's some reminders of the fact I was homeless. There's some reminders of the fact I went to prison. There's some reminders of the fact that at one time in my life, I didn't have a clue what the hell I was talking about. I thought I was smart. I thought I was the smartest kid in the room. I'm just like, okay, I'm a genius and I'm the greatest. And I was so dumb, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember where I came from, and use that as like a starting point. Like, what do I care about? What are my values? You know, because like the values that I have that make up who I am and that drive me should mean more than anything else. And I'm glad that I have people to keep me in check as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like being in this position, I could have gone down the path of like, hey, like I'm gonna make a TV show. I don't know. Like, I mean, they'll put anything on these, you know, networks these days. You know, I could have let a documentary crew like follow me the whole time, I do have a documentary crew that kind of followed me around, but it wasn't like every aspect of my life. And I said, no, actually, like, leave us alone for a bit. You know, and yeah, like, there's a lot of reminders of the experiences that I've had and the people who have. And I think the most important lesson that I've learned in all this is I trust and I love and I care about the people who stayed with me the whole time. The people who didn't forget about me, the people who kept sending letters. And there's a very, very specific set of people that I really care about who did that. And y'all sent me, at the last hope, y'all sent me several hundred cards. So hope has definitely been, the people who come here have definitely been on that list.
Ooh, thank you guys.
Woo! Oh, and 2012 and 2014, the same thing happened. Very consistent.
Every 2 years, the hope flood of letters comes in. So going back to this audience, it seems like a lot of people have been interested in engaging politically, but aren't sure of the best way to do that. Like, where do you recommend people focus their efforts?
We live in really tough and trying times. And it, for some of us, we've already, you know, like a lot of people have known that, you know, that things have been going in this direction for quite some time. I certainly figured it out by the time we went to Iraq in 2010. I saw all the pieces of authoritarianism and all the tools that of the police state and the military and the intelligence apparatus start to come together, you know, and coalesce and crystallize. So a lot of these new things that came out, you know, in the early 2000s were really starting to solidify, and you know, and this was under a liberal, you know, mm-hmm. administration, and I realized that, you know, like this is happening, and I think that the important thing to remember is that we all have political agency. We all have power, and we all have the ability to do things. And not, I know I said this thing about developers and ethics, but like that really this applies to everyone at all, in all aspects. You know, like do your situation better, so like do something. Like, and you don't always, you know, like you have more political agency than going to a ballot box. You have more political agency than, you know, than writing a letter or a petition, or, you know, even going to a protest and carrying a sign. You know, you have way more than that. And in a sense, every decision that you make can be interpreted as a political decision. You know, whether or not you want to like. Whether or not you want to like throw the, I mean, if you've got a cup and you want to throw it away, or do you want to like, you know, if you've got a disposable cup, do you want to throw it away or recycle it? You know, like that, like these kinds of like small everyday decisions, and the people that we have to our left and to our right, the people that we have, like let's look towards each other right now, there's nobody that's gonna come and save us from this grand, huge, authoritarian, you know, machine that's international. And like, you know, like, yeah, we keep talking about the US, but like, this is happening all across the world right now. And technology is really empowering some very dangerous people and very dangerous institutions. And in order for us to combat that, we have to look towards each other. And also nobody can give you hope. That's an, like, I don't know how to tell you this, but like you can't, it's not something that's given to you. It's not like a commodity. Like I have hope, therefore I'm giving it unto you. Like it's something that we have inherently inside of us. You have to find. So like, and you know, it's easy to forget that. I kept on having to relearn this while I was in prison. Like actually, this is something like I'm going to continue to fight. I'm going to continue to move forward. I'm going to continue to hope. I'm going to continue to maybe, you know, expect to make a difference. And that's something that we should do, especially, you know, whenever we're exhausted and we feel isolated. It's like, yes, you're supposed to feel tired. You're supposed to feel isolated. That's like how we get broken down, you know? So we have to resist that by like lifting up everybody else and, you know, lifting up ourselves, because, you know, like that's how we'll be able to get through this. And, you know, I expected to spend 35 years in prison. And so I knew like I was going to spend that amount of time. Like you couldn't change that. You couldn't, I was like, okay, like I accept that. I'm going to be here for a very long time. That didn't stop me from like continuing to be out there and continuing to be involved and continuing to write and continuing to speak out, as difficult as that was and as time consuming as that was and as exhausting as that was, especially from prison. And, you know, even whenever there wasn't light at the end of the tunnel, even whenever it looked like this was never going to happen, like I was never going to set foot, like, the first time that we met after a few years, like neither of us expected me to get out soon.
Yeah.
I mean, like what? Like shortly after the last hope, we talked to each other, and you know, like neither of us thought that this was going to happen, like what we would be sitting here. I mean, I think we joked, like, you know, we would do this interview, which is why it's me on, Jan. We like joked about that, but like, I didn't think it was going to happen. I didn't think I was going to be here, but you know, so like, yeah, like you, maybe you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel, but that doesn't mean that it's not there. It doesn't mean the end of the tunnel isn't there. You know, it just means you can't see it yet. So you just got to keep going. Yeah.
So I know you've dealt with these feelings of depression and burnout occasionally, and that must be really difficult as such a public person where, like, you know, you feel like the spotlight's on you and everyone's watching. Do you have advice for people who are feeling depressed or burnt out due to, you know, like feeling like nothing's getting better or changing?
Yeah, it's okay. Like, depression and anxiety are real. They're normal. Lots of people get this stuff. I mean, as a public figure, I'm openly willing to admit, like, hey, you know, I have to deal with depression. I see a therapist on a fairly regular basis. You know, I have a psychiatrist. You know, I take varying levels of medications on occasion, depending on my mood and depending on what I've been through and where I'm at in my life. And that's okay. You can ask for that. You can say, hey, I need help. Hey, and we can help each other out, you know. It's real and it's scary, and a lot of us have these demons and a lot of us have to fight with this, and I hope that we can come to a point where most people are willing to accept that it's not weakness to like be depressed. It's not a sign of any, it's just chemicals in your brain are just like, oh, well, you're depressed now, you know, like you got this imbalance thing. So like, it's not, and you know, like some, you know, and this is the part that I think a lot of people forget is like getting a depression can be completely not related to your situation in life, you know? Things can be going really well, but you're like, oh my God, my life is ending, you know? It doesn't make sense, but like, that's brain chemistry. Brain chemistry doesn't make sense sometimes.
Yeah. So you've probably been the target of more online trolling and hatred than like 99.999% of people.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
I don't read it.
Ignore it.
You know, and I have a policy. I've had a policy for several years of not reading about myself. And you know, I've fallen in for that trap before. You know, and I did it recently, where I just started. I started to obsess over what people were saying and thinking, and I'm just like. Now I've like taken a step back from that. I say, hey, actually, you know, like I'm okay. And like, you know, there's not a whole, you know, like I'm doing fine actually. You know, like I started spending too much time on Twitter on my alts, and I think that was the problem. I started using alts, and you know, and I started to get sucked in, and then that started to start to show on my regular Twitter account, which is much more thoughtful. I mean, I really think about the tweets that I'm about to do sometimes, but I was thinking less and less about that, and so, it's been tough, and I'm back to just, you know, like living life and doing normal stuff again. So I'm not obsessing on Twitter.
Speaking of Twitter, do you think there's a problem with the role of social media in politics and fake news and all that?
And actually, I think it goes back to algorithms. Machine learning has picked up on the fact that we're now being hyper-stimulated. Like, this machine learning is like finding that little spot in your, you know, the reptilian part of our brain to like encourage us to generate more content, which then generates more content. And so these algorithms are creating a feedback loop. And so that feedback loop is like, hey, let's make people, you know what really gets people going on Twitter? When they're angry and they're upset about something and something crazy and unexpected is happening. So like now the algorithms are encouraging that, and that's why we see so much weird stuff happening, is because, you know, these algorithms are honing in on this on this little meme generating, you know, weakness in our brain, where, you know, now the memes spread. you know, and it is just like DNA. Like this information, I get the sense is actually trying to, you know, like in a sense without like cause or direction, but it's, you know, like we're the vehicles of reproduction for information, and like Twitter is, Twitter and Facebook and these social media algorithms are exploiting that, and yeah, so we see all these social effects from that, but they're actually stemming from this thing that's happening to our brains.
Mm-hmm. Like, what do you think can be done about that? Because it seems like if that keeps going, you know, people just get more and more extreme about their views.
Yeah, and we need to stop. I mean, it's just as simple as that. Like, we need to
log out.
I mean, it's not even just log out, because like we still need these tools to like communicate, but like maybe we should stop picking and choosing what people see, you know, like algorithmically. You know, because what's happening is we're getting stuck in these bubbles, and I get that feeling sometimes too, where I have to like leave and exit from this bubble universe that I'm a part of. Like I can't exit that sometimes, but so I have to like look outside of it, and it's really it's really tough, but we can do that, and reading books helps me, certainly. Reading about like other things that are going on that I'm not familiar with, so things that I don't necessarily have an interest in. Mm-hmm. I actually find this is something that's been very profound for me, and I think allows you to step outside of that. Mm-hmm. Outside of that bubble, because all these algorithms are just going to find the things that you really are already into and then like get you wound up. Yeah. And and it happens to everyone, even me.
Are there any books or sources of information you would recommend to this audience?
Wow, that's a long list.
Maybe just a couple.
I have like a whole bookshelf, and I always worry, especially whenever I like, you know, because like I've learned things from books that I don't necessarily endorse, and I think that's something that I try to keep tight internally, is that even though I might not endorse or agree with a book, I had a takeaway from that. So I read stuff that I don't necessarily agree with, and I think that's how you become exposed to different ideas and how you generate an actual more nuanced view and opinion of the world is by, you know, like, I guess the recommendation is not a specific book. It's find information that you don't know. Find opinions that you don't necessarily agree with and learn about them. Mm-hmm. Learn about what they are, and you can understand your position better and your thoughts better and where you sit in society better. And maybe you do agree with something. Yeah.
Cool. How do you find, like, how do you search out opinions that you don't necessarily agree with? Like, where do you go for that information?
I go to... There's no source that's credible, no individual source. So you have to like, and you know, and I'm going to put my intelligence analyst hat on because this is how I work. You know, it's how I did my job back then. Is you corroborate lots of different sources, and they have varying degrees of veracity, and you can like categorize the veracity of those. And so you have to like. An aspect of critical thinking is understanding that your secondary sources are going through a filter. You know, you're being told about something. You know, a news article is telling you about something, but and it's not that, you know, and it might sound unbiased, but like how they frame it and what they're withholding and what these things mean is very important to keep in mind. So. In order to get, if you don't have access to, say, a primary source, which, and I have the privilege of access to this kind of thing, I get to, if not everybody does, but if something's going on and I want to know something about, like, hey, what's up with this, I can just ask somebody. I can just email somebody and be like, hey, what's the story with this? That's the most valuable way that you can learn about something, but that's not accessible to everyone. But you can file FOIA requests, especially if it involves like government stuff or scandals and things like that. Those are very effective. I've done hundreds of FOIA requests myself. Not all of them have been fruitful, but I've learned something from them all. So seeking out primary sources is, I think, the ultimate thing that you can do. And it's the ultimate thing that I do, is I find the email. Like, I find that email that everybody's, like, mad about, and I'm like, okay, what does it say? Oh, it's actually not that bad, you know? Right. Like, it's being blown out of context or whatever. But, like, actually seeing a primary source is where I try to find information. LexisNexis is a good resource as well.
Got it. So we're going to open up the floor for Q&A right about now. We'd like to ask that if you are part of an underrepresented group at HOPE, you can go first. Or, you know, if you don't usually speak up at these Q&A sessions. I know it can be intimidating when there's a lot of people in line.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, trans women, people of color, trans people, et cetera. Non-EU, non-US people.
Yeah, hi. Chelsea, I just want to say thank you for being here, and thank you for, you know, everything you've done, all the sacrifice you've gone through, and especially thanks for your Senate primary campaign and the platform that you put forward. As a member of the LGBTQ community myself, and you know, someone who shares your worldview, it would have been great. You know, it'd be great to see your platform, in my opinion, great to see your platform, you know, come to pass in this country. And in the midst of everything going on right now, I'm actually encouraged and optimistic, because they're right here in New York City. We do have a candidate who did win her primary, Alexandria Ortiz Cortez.
Right.
And you know, her platform shared a lot of the same things your platform did, about abolition of ICE. Prison reform and incarceration.
I'm not for reform of prisons. For way more than that.
So I just would love to hear your comments on, you know, her victory over Jill Crowley, and your thoughts on the Democratic Socialist movement.
Ooh, DSA. I mean, I'm encouraged by what I see from some parts of DSA, but I think that it's, you know, like, DSA has been going through, you know, like a rejuvenation phase, and so there's a lot of growing pains with that. And I'd like to see where, you know, DSA in particular lands on some of these things, because I don't think that's been worked out yet. Yeah, I'm definitely paying attention to the things that are going on with, you know, people who are, whether or not they're officially DSA or whether or not they're aligned with DSA or just associated with, but I'm very encouraged.
Great, thanks.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hey.
Hi. So I have a question regarding, so in a lot of developing countries or even communities here in the US where resources are limited or restricted, a lot of people are just happy to have a platform to be able to create or to innovate. In the beginning of this talk, you talked about how we should perhaps police ourselves in what we work on or create or develop.
Yeah.
Do you believe maybe, or this is actually my question, should we perhaps choose who do we work for, or question maybe who's given us the platform or the resources, rather than not create at all?
Absolutely. I mean, that is exactly what I'm saying. And in many respects, I've made this mistake. I've worked for a startup company that was unscrupulous, to say the least. I mean, I've written software at various stages in my life that I regret writing, you know, because it was done without, it was done with not necessarily a nefarious intent, but it was done kind of carelessly. It was like, okay, I'm going to meet this criteria. I'm going to make this system do exactly what the boss says it's going to do. And you know, I was young and I was an intern back then. So I used to work at this photo hosting company way back when, and it's no longer a thing. So it was definitely not Flickr or Instagram. It did not make it. Did not survive, but I learned a lot about, you know, how you do have to pick your own, you know, you, if you can, and I understand the difficulty with this, you know, is that in the society we're in, like, you've got to pay the bills, you've got to get bread on the table, and but I think that if you do have the choice, then the choice that you make is very important and is definitely a reflection of it, you know, like, it should be a reflection of the values you have, and you know, if something doesn't exist, then consider the possibility that you might be able to create something new. You might be able to create something different. Maybe there's other people that you're around and you think the same way, and you have like a new idea and a new concept that's not necessarily one of the ones that exist. You know, like. You know, like that, like, you know, if you want to get into cryptography, like, do you need to work for the NSA? I mean, not necessarily. If you want to work on drones, you don't have to necessarily work for Boeing or Lockheed Martin. You know, like, choosing when you can is, I think, very important.
Thank you.
Thank you. Especially at Hope. Let's be honest, like, there's a lot of people who are mercenaries in this room.
Hi. My real question is, what about gender discrimination, where people know who you are or don't know who you are? And if I see you on the street, I'll just call you Elizabeth or something, not to bring attention to you?
Wait, what's that?
If I see you on the street, I'm not going to, like, announce to the world who I'm talking. I'll just call you Elizabeth.
If when I'm getting coffee, I'm Liz. I mean,
yeah. Oh, cool. All right. So anyway, no, the question is, what about gender discrimination? When people know who you are, when they don't know who you are, or just when you look out there and see it, you've seen things.
Yeah. And so, like, yeah, definitely. I had a privilege drop. So, I went from having white male privilege to having, like, white trans woman privilege, which is a totally different game. It's a totally different environment. And that's really hard to deal with, 'cause I'm not used to it all the time. And I shouldn't have to deal with that, obviously, but it's a real phenomenon, and it's something that I've experienced. Biggest offender is, like, whenever I go to, like, Micro Center and I'm, like, walking down the store and, like, you know, people want to, like, you know, white middle class males come up to me and they're like, hey, you know, like, they're telling me stuff about technology, and I'm like, like, I know what I'm doing. I know what I'm looking for. Actually, that, you know, what you're saying is not what I'm looking for at all, you know, like, what, you know, same with the hardware store. Like, I know tools. I worked in a wood shop for 3.5 years. I kind of know my stuff whenever it comes to, like, woodworking and tools and working with this kind of thing. And being explained things is, like, the most annoying thing that I've had to deal with. And, you know, when I was in the room, like, you know, like, there would just happen to be a pallet jack in there. I started playing with the pallet jack, and somebody commented and was like, hey, you know how to use a pallet jack? And I'm like, yeah, I've used one for years, you know? So, yeah, like, I think, you know, like, mansplaining, as it's, you know, sometimes called, but it's not just that, you know, like, I think there's an assumption, and it doesn't just come from, you know, white cis men. I think it comes from a broader swath of society that kind of expects, you know, unless you know precisely who I am and you know my background, then you're going to make assumptions based on the way I look, and I don't think that's right.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you so much for your courage and your heroism.
Thank you.
My question is about what was the nature of the communication that the Obama administration had with you before your release? Because it seems like that administration statistically was kind of the most vicious one of any presidency towards whistleblowers. And I'm just wondering how that happened, if you have a perspective on that.
Oh, yeah. So this is a really complicated one. We didn't know anything. We just heard stuff. That's pretty much how that went down. We heard rumors offline, unconfirmed, months before that it was being considered. It was a shot in the dark. We had no idea where the coin was going to go down, or which side of the coin it was going to land on. And I don't think the administration had made a decision until the day they decided, to be perfectly honest. There was no official communications, but certainly we were paying attention. We were trying to read the tea leaves as to what they were doing and what was going on at the time. I want to use this opportunity to be I'm very thankful that this happened. You know, yes, the administration was really, really, really bad on press freedom, on journalists, on sources, consistently bad, and on so many things. You know, drone strikes, the Iraq war continuing, Yemen, Libya, etc. And I think that I'm not giving them a free pass on that, but. I do appreciate getting released out of prison. It's some consolation, at least. So, thanks. Thank you. Aw.
Hi. Super interesting to hear you as a person more than just leaking 8 years ago and sort of trying to rebuild yourself, post-prison. I'm curious what you, want your legacy or history to look like, what you are trying to build towards, so when history looks back, you have a Wikipedia page, right?
Yeah, it's changing constantly too. I have noticed that. I went from a convicted leaker to a whistleblower and convicted leaker to politician and activist and whistleblower. So I'm not done yet. Trust me, I got plenty of stuff down the line. I don't really care about my legacy in terms of what history writes, because history is going to get written by somebody else, and get reinterpreted by somebody else 50, 100 years from now. I often think about this whenever we look back at history, and the more that we learn about a particular period, we find that actually we just had stereotypes of this different particular time frame before, and the normal things were going on, and and stuff. And I think that might happen with history, is that it tends, and there's a lot of inaccurate things on my Wikipedia page and on the history about this case that, I know that they're wrong, but I'm not gonna fight it or anything like that. I'm not so focused on it that I'm gonna try to correct it. I'm 30 years old. I'm about to turn 31, maybe in a few months, and I'm just getting started. I just started doing stuff again, I hope that my legacy is one of doing work for 30, 40 years, and not one of, the one thing that I don't want to be a one hit wonder. I want to be the legend, I guess. That'd be kind of cool. To be the pop star type, less, House of Pain and more Madonna, I guess.
I just want to acknowledge you on behalf of our community for the great work that you've done, for standing up for human rights, for showing a great amount of empathy despite all. Everything around you, and I just want to acknowledge you for being an amazing human being.
Oh, thank you. But, I mean, do you have a question?
Yes, I do.
Okay, cool.
So, also, Jan's work with Brave is really awesome.
Yes! I want to give you a shout out real fast.
So,
I work with Jan. Jan is amazing and does great work. When you first told me about Brave, I was like, oh, this is a great project. I'm so thrilled and so excited. How are you going to get this, like, how are you going to do this tokens thing? I think the first question I asked.
And my question is, like, you said that you needed, you know, if someone hiring, the Ethereum Foundation is hiring. And I'm sure that
I have opinions on blockchain.
Well,
I'll just say that
there are really good projects that have a lot of integrity that would benefit from your sysadmin skills.
I mean, I have opinions on blockchain. That's all I'll say.
Cool. Well, thanks.
Hi.
Hey.
When you were in prison, receiving letters from people, did you like to hear about goings on in the free world, or would that amplify your oppression? Would you want to hear about, like, a stranger's day, or is that a little creepy? Do you have any words of advice for aspiring writers of letters to prisoners to try to uplift them?
There's no format. There's no correct way to write a letter. Just write. Some people would just tell me how their day was, and I like that. I liked that. It doesn't have to be special. It doesn't have, whenever I was getting letters in prison, I just liked the fact that people were even writing to me. So, I mean, I got pictures. Some people just doodled stuff, which I thought was cool. I mean, there's one person in particular out in Michigan who would just send me doodles. And I one time just sent her doodles back. And yeah, like that was like, it can be whatever. It's just, it's not about the content of the letter. It's about the connection that you're establishing. Hey, you're not forgotten. You're loved. You're appreciated. You have people out here who value you. You have inherent value. And just sending something, it doesn't have to be anything special. Just maybe it can just be, and I've gotten one sentence letters before, and those are fine too. Like, hey, thinking about you, period. I mean, obviously we're in the age of text messaging and, you know, Signal, so it's kind of that in that style, I guess. But yeah, thank you.
Hi, I'm not going to have a deep question. I am a political activist.
Woo!
Thank you. And I've been trying to reach you before all this talk that you're doing in the last year, and I'm too tired to go through 3 hours of trying to get hold of your people.
Okay.
Now we are a bubble apart. How do I get 2 hours with you to talk about project and things like that? What is the way to get hold of your people so there is no middleware people who will be saying that guy is crazy, this is this and that?
Yeah, that is a common dilemma with public figures that I must admit. You can find, yeah, is Janice here? Yeah, like, find this person and you
okay.
can get a, like, there. Like, I have a point of contact in this room that will, that
oh,
I
oh, okay, that, I'll look for them.
Yeah, so if you can, I can't see you, so, like, we should find you offline and I will get back to you, like, with whatever you want to talk about. Because, yeah, it's really difficult to reach me. It's always been that way. And it's kind of, I'm not happy about it, but when you get as much requests as me, like, it has to be, otherwise I'm spending all day going through requests. Hey.
Hi. I do have a question for you. I want to preface it by saying that I'm the 5 o'clock speaker.
And woo!
I am going to be talking quite a bit about you. So
awesome.
And considerably less reverentially than you've been experiencing for the past couple hours. So in general fairness, I hope you'll come to my talk and tell me everything that I'm getting wrong. Just trying to be fair about it. My question to you is regarding Mr. Assange.
Okay.
In reviewing, let's just say, your case file to prepare for my talk, in part, and interviewing some people who have considerably more knowledge about your case than I do, it began to appear to me that either on purpose or by accident, you gave the U.S. government the means to indict Mr. Assange, that there is now an arrest warrant out for Mr. Assange based in part on either what you admitted or volunteered or whatever the correct word is. So would you care to comment on that rumor or expand on it or whatever?
No, I don't know what you're talking about, first off, but second off, I don't really have the ability. Unfortunately, like the stuff that happened in 2010, the case, as you know, is
statute of limitations is up.
Not for like if I re-leak something, then I can get charged for that. So if I'm under a non-disclosure agreement about the case file, so there was closed hearings. I can't talk about what was in those hearings, and I won't. I'm not going to violate those. You know, I don't want to get arrested again.
So it had nothing to do with your sentence being commuted. You can't talk about it.
Can we move? I'd like to move on from this question since you're speaking at 5 p.m. You can open a discussion then.
I don't know. In that regard, the commutation was completely unrelated to anything like that.
Hi.
I 100% deny that. Yeah, that's an easy one.
Hey. So I am a mathematician or cryptographer, and I guess I would love to hear if you have plans or thoughts or what capacity you want to like further pursue cryptography or the Ring LWE stuff that you're reading about, which is really exciting.
Yeah, I do. I have a lot of comments on that. I work a lot with cryptography now. I really care about cryptography. I'm really concerned about quantum computing in regards to that, which is why I was interested in post-quantum cryptography. I think that y'all need to pay more attention to quantum computing in regards to RSA. I'm not trying to explain that, but please take quantum computing more seriously right now, because RSA is vulnerable and we need a replacement. And so for at least for the public key for public key infrastructure. I do plan on doing work in this regard. That's one of the reasons. One of the reasons why I write in Rust is because cryptography works very well in a Rust environment because it's memory, because it's memory safe and it's very, it's, as a low level programming language, it's very efficient and you can put it onto hardware devices. You can put binaries and flash them to devices and make hardware encryption possible. I think that I'm gonna start writing implementations of cryptography and to varying degrees, and gaining that knowledge and experience of doing the applications. So I'm more interested in applied cryptography and the analysis of that cryptography than I am in the actual. Although I love math, I love playing around with those symbols, actually implementing something is, I think, that something that is necessary and we need to do right now. And so we'll take one more question, I think. I think that's all we got time for.
Oh, God, the pressure's on.
Yeah, sorry.
Hey, Jan. So I wanted to circle back on ethics and technology.
Yes.
Interaction designer and researcher. I look at Neil Postman's 6 questions for the analysis of, you know, potential technologies and looking at the you know, unintended consequences and shifts of power. And I was curious if you had a similar framework or set of questions that you like to use when you're evaluating a technology.
I'm trying to develop this right now. You know, like initially it's a lot of gut instincts and sort of like an understanding of very complex systems and how, you know, you can maybe predict some of the, like, how a fractal feedback loop environment will operate. But I'm trying to write down, like, the questions that you should go through and ask for different systems. I would love to be able to consult people and tell people, like, what things you should be looking for, what the warning signs are, and it's less about the specifics and more about developing a general method in the same sense that doctors have like an ethical, like, you know, method that they go through and they do an analysis of ethical situations and complex moral dilemmas. We don't have that yet, and I think that we should be writing this down. I have come up with some proposals behind the scenes, but they're not ready for publication.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Cool. And that's all the time we have.
Hey!
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming.
Thanks, Chelsea.
I'm going to be in the Hardware Hackers Lounge area. So, see ya.